What you are about to listen to may contain explicit language, adult themes,
that's f***ing right,
and things that may not be suitable for viewers under 18. Listening discretion is strongly advised.
This content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatments. In other words, we're not your motherfucking doctors. Always use best practice guidelines as described by your institutions. Now, on with the show.
Oh, shit, I forgot we are recording.
Yeah, you're reacting and you're more susceptible and prone to actually getting exposures. And right, and like I told, like I tell everyone I orient and I train and students, even experienced people, it only takes one phone call in the middle of the night to the needle stick hotline to make you be like, what was I thinking? Welcome to another episode of Respiratory on Ice, where we discuss all things pulmonary critical care while gracefully consuming adult beverages. I'm your host, Justin Phillips, along with my homies,
Lance Bongolina
and Rob Bautista.
How you guys doing today?
I could still use a haircut.
I think the three of us could definitely use haircuts.
Yeah, well, I tried cutting it the other day.
What do you call that haircut that you have?
It's called a Caesar salad because it's not a Caesar cut.
like it's almost like a bowl, but there's two bowls.
Well, it's there's the top bowl.
There's like the top bowl and then the bottom bowl. It's like a, it's almost like a tiered wedding cake.
Well, maybe the half bowl special. I don't know.
Or an insulated cup.
Yeah, like an insulated cup. Like if you took the cup, flip it up upside down, like you got the two different layers.
Hey, maybe I'll get something going here, huh? If anyone's listening, give it a try.
I mean, it's cool.
I give God the credit for this hair that I have growing.
And Justin is going for the...
Yeah. Pull that hat off. Let's see what you got going.
I believe they call it the castaway special. You know, this is where you start yelling, Wilson!
Or as in the hospital terms, we would call it the CEWA special.
Hey, what's the score, Rob? What's the score right now?
Pretty high.
What about your haircut over there? I mean, I don't know, man.
Yeah, it's getting kind of long, but it's semi-maintained. I'm getting some buck shots off to the side of the head right now.
I feel like I've seen that haircut on the TFC Filipino channel a couple of times.
I have Uncle Boy here right now.
Yeah.
Definitely. Hey, it's funny. I've got a comment about like how our show is, you can hear the Filipino-based commentary on here.
from anyone specifically or just in general?
Just generally.
Do you think like ABS-CBN would pick us up?
Hey, that'd be kind of cool.
didn't they just get knocked off? Didn't they just like lose their lease or something?
Oh, I don't know. I think they
just like lost their lease or title or franchise corporation or something, but I think they just went out of business.
It's only TFC now.
Is right?
I don't know. I mean, I'm Filipino, but I don't know that much about Filipino shows and whatnot.
Okay. All right. Well, that's cool. Outside of that, any new cocktails, boys? What are you guys drinking today?
One of my favorite single malt scotch whiskeys is Laphroaig. Kind of a peatier flavor.
Like in terms Pablo of or
scotch, yeah, exactly. You drink it, your voice just turns into that raspy. Take your shirt off.
It's like a helicopter.
Wow, Petey Pablo, we just dated ourselves, didn't we?
Wait, forget your drink. favorite rap artist of like.
You're just going to cut my...
Prime 2000. Prime early 2000s.
Wow, you can't just throw that question out of nowhere. That's a hard question to answer.
You're telling me you don't like Petey Pablo?
I do like...
I'm a little older, so what about 1990s?
Okay. I'll make it easier for you. Petey Pablo.
There you go. Okay.
This is or
But Nelly?
No. Petey Pablo or Mystical?
Wow. Shake the ass.
Tell me what you're working with.
Petey Pablo or Mystical?
Wow, you really didn't date 2000 pretty well. You went with those two out of everybody in 2000, did you?
I mean, you were talking about Petey, like Petey Pablo popped in mind.
I choose neither of those. Jesus.
No, you have to pick one. Okay. We're repping the South. Petey Pablo, Mystical, or Master P.
Oh, I'm definitely going with Master P. Nah, for sure. Nah.
I would have said Petey Pablo.
Yeah? didn't he show up on like some movie? Oh, yeah, it was like that Nick
Drumline.
Yeah, there it is.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the hell he was. Yeah, he was pointless in that show because he didn't do any of his popular songs. He was just pointless.
But I don't think Petey Pablo drinks Lafroy. Well, I don't know. Maybe he does. Yeah. Anyways, I mixed that up with I turned it into a highball. I've never had a highball. It's a scotch and soda.
You never had alcohol in a glass with soda?
No. Well, in this particular sense, I mean, I don't like club soda on its own. So pour that in. Some LaFroy, some ice, and it's not bad. It's not bad at all, actually.
Would you prefer it without the soda?
I think I would. I think I'd take it neat.
But now you're stuck. Now you have to drink it.
Yeah, I do. I think I'm going to pour some more LaFroy in here in a second, but yeah.
That smokiness, peatiness.
Yeah, I really like it. It's an acquired taste. I mean, not a lot of people like peaty whiskeys, but yeah.
It's also one of the Ilas, like from the island of Ila.
Yeah.
Ila Musk.
Right. ISLAY Musk.
Ila Musk.
Get him out of California. I'm fine with that.
Is Ila Musk the sibling that lost their damn mind?
Like, you smart, but you're gonna start giving out medical advice? No thanks, I'm good, thank you.
Eli lost her damn mind.
I'd like a Tesla.
I mean, I would like a Tesla too. I mean, it wouldn't hurt me either way. We
have a bunch of coworkers that have Teslas.
We have a couple that have Teslas. They're nice cars.
Would you buy that tank of have you seen that one, the indestructible glass Tesla tank of a SUV?
The Cybertruck? Yeah.
Yeah. Would you guys buy that?
No. I would buy a Rivian, though. So there's like another competitor that's coming out with like electronic cars.
Is it the Nevo or Nuvo?
No, I believe that's a ring.
Or a bottle of alcohol.
It's either a bottle of like vodka-based alcohol that got nowhere in, you know, the 2010s. Or I believe it's a form of birth control that comes in the shape of a ring.
Oh, that's what you're talking about. What are you guys drinking?
I'm drinking a Dark and Stormy.
What is that?
Classic Caribbean drink, but there's different variations. Like, it's actually been patented by like Gosling's Black Seal Rum. I'm not using Gosling's Black Seal Rum. I'm using Plantation. We're looking for a sponsor. Plantation Rums, OFTD, original, fashion, traditional, dark, 69%, so it's about 138 overproof. I made a simple syrup with pandan leaves and lime zest, and then I'm using Fever Tree ginger beer.
Oh, I think I'm going to try that later. Sounds good.
That's cool.
Does it actually have that dark and stormy color you're talking about?
I'll show you in just a sec. Hold on.
I'm sure it looks fairly like layered. Hurry the fuck up. We want to see this. Wow. Galing, galing.
I was just going to say that. Man, we're Filipino. Okay. Oh, man. That does look
That's good. That's cool. How's it taste?
It's pretty damn good. Fever Tree has a very strong ginger flavor, which is kind of nice.
When you have like ginger beer, like, how do you like it? Because I, you know, there's been like different manufacturers, and like you could obviously make your own. Do you like the ones that are more like taste more spicy, like soda, or do you like really spicy gingery flavor? Because I like it really like almost to the point where you can't stand like the spice.
So the two of the bigger ones that are like that are Fever Tree and Bundaberg are pretty damn strong flavor. Bundaberg has a pretty strong flavor, and that's one of the ones that you see used everywhere, but I like Fever Tree. It's like spicy, and if you drink it straight, you're like, holy shit, did I just bite into a thumb of piece of ginger? Like, it's pretty damn strong, but it's good.
So the ginger beer actually makes a huge difference in terms of making the darkness for me?
Absolutely.
100%. Yeah, I think it's just like what, like any like ginger based cocktail. They're not equal, you know, across the board on how they're made. Obviously, they all have their own recipes. Some are like more carbonated beverages that are ginger, almost like ginger ale. And then There are quite a few that have a really, really strong like ginger presence. Where yeah, like it's really spicy. So it's like either you like it or you don't.
And Fever Tree is good because it tastes pretty damn good, and it's available at Costco.
We need a sponsor there too, or
you get to go to the front of the line already.
I know,
right? There's still long lines at Costco. It's crazy.
Hey, but you're essential, so
right? Not a hero.
What are you drinking, Jess?
I am drinking a cocktail called the Jack Rose, which the origins, I don't know exactly where it's from.
The Titanic.
not the Titanic. I've heard like conflicting stories of Washington State and New Jersey, which obviously are, you know, miles apart. But the history on the spirit's kind of interesting. Or not necessarily Jack Rose, but so Jack Rose is essentially just one of my favorite spirits, which is Applejack, which is really just apple brandy, grenadine, and lime juice. So if you are not completely like familiar with grenadine is just pomegranate. So it's definitely, so it gets a little bit of sweet from the pomegranate and a lot of tart, you know, as well from that and the lime juice lemon juice. So yeah, apple brandy, pomegranate, AKA grenadine, and lime or lemon. If you're not familiar with Applejack, it's, there's a long history of it in the United States.
One of the makers is Laird's.
Laird's is like the original Applejack. It's a very, very proofy type of spirit, but it's just really apple brandy. And well before the three of us were around, and most people, when apple makers made apples in the U.S. and it came to the winter time, you had a couple of things to do with apples. Either you baked with it, you let it die, you make cider, or you make Applejack or apple brandy. So just like cider, apple brandy or Applejack is kind of like really an American spirit. It was what we did with apples, so we didn't let them go to waste in the winter.
So if you're not making Martinelli's, you're making apple brandy.
And if you're not making Martinelli's, you're making some other type of hard cider. and hard cider came before Martinelli's.
Oh, no, like an angry orchard.
Well, I mean, not angry orchard, but yeah, alcoholic cider came before what the 8-year-olds drink on, you know, New Year's Eve. What a good time.
Speaking of good times, how about now in PPE?
Okay, let's talk about PPE.
Let's do it.
I think you know this is a cool topic, and it also strikes a nerve with me. Let me ask you guys a question. Have you heard the phrase, you need to be able to help yourself before you can help others? I phrase the question because it seems kind of obvious. You kind of got to look out for yourself before you look out for someone else. It's easier to think of that in like common day scenarios, whatever. You don't donate sometimes if you're super broke, or you know, you make sure everyone in your family is taken care of and yourself is taken care of before you reach out to others. Even you know, other examples that we could think of is like firefighters and cops and you know, paramedics and stuff like that, right? They make sure that they have the tools to protect themselves and their partners and their crew before they go in and necessarily help the general public, right? Firefighters don't run into buildings, at least to my knowledge, without, you know, appropriate hoses and axes.
Respirators.
And, you know, same thing with like the police department. They make sure they have the appropriate gear when they enter hostile environments. And, you know, like my life prior to respiratory was in the trajectory of being a paramedic. And, you know, in EMT school, they taught us, was just like, look, man, you could be here all you want, but if you go down, guess what? You're out of the equation. And the people that you are going to go help are still like in need of help. So conceptually, when we frame things like in that aspect, it's like a no-brainer. Yeah. Help yourself before you help others. Why is it such a hard thing to swallow sometimes when we're in the hospital?
I think it's because you have good intentions for somebody and you're hoping to do the best for them. And maybe that kind of overrides that cessation of helping yourself first.
Well, it's when we think about it, it's hard to fight your instincts and your reactions that you've been trained for however long you've been doing it. For some of these people, they've been doing this for 20 odd plus years. When they hear a code call, what do? You run into the room, you assess the patient, and you start going at it. But with COVID and other things like this, with isolations, it's wait, no. You need to take 5 minutes or whatever it takes, put on your gear, and then jump in there because you need to protect yourself. It's like what Justin was talking about, like firefighters or policemen. Like policemen, for instance, you're not going to go into a gunfight with only your baton. You're not ready for it. You're going to jump into a COVID room barefaced and just all of a sudden COVID all over your face? No. You need to be ready for what you're getting into.
Where does like the mindset of screw myself, I need to be in there come from?
Well, I don't know if it's initially screw myself. It's remember in when we were talking about when I talked about like Dan Pink's three intrinsic motivators.
One of those
motivators is purpose. Doing something for something greater than yourself. You have a goal that's greater than yourself. And in our case, we've moved into healthcare because we want to help people and we want to get people out of the hospital. We're looking to help people, and that's our purpose. We want people to live and survive.
Yeah, I like that rationale.
That's what we're working towards. Sometimes that gets in the way of your belief of self and your protection of self. Like, I'm going to help this person even if it costs me what I'm doing.
Yeah. And
is that to your detriment? In some cases, absolutely.
And you're right. And I think at the moment of like you use the code, like you said, I don't think you think twice about yourself in that instinct. You see somebody fall and faint. You might try to reach out and catch them or something, right? It's a natural reaction to something you do every single day, like Rob said. So I like that sense that you phrase it that way.
It's like we do this because we have altruistic beliefs that we're looking to help people. We don't always think about ourselves when it comes to these situations. And that's the hard part is you have to think about yourself, because if you take yourself out of the equation, that's how many other people that you aren't going to be able to help.
Or how many other people are going to have to help you at that moment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So intuitively, when like we sit down and have these conversations, it's a no-brainer. And we're like, oh yeah, I wouldn't do that. And, you know, like that's silly. That's foolish. Mm-hmm. They're like, why would anyone put themselves at risk? And we use all these examples. And then we always seem to be just jumping in there and reacting. And we also should try to, within our own individual disciplines and communities, realize that this is a real problem. Exposure is multifactorial. It is a product of not having PPE, but it is also being smart when you do.
For myself, it goes into the response versus react. So for react, you see a situation, you jump right in. No thinking, you just instinctive, just go right in. Response, you take a second or two to evaluate the situation. Understand what you're getting into and what you need to do. Because there's plenty of times where, yeah, I just had a situation probably 2 or 3 weeks ago. PUI coded. People wanted to run into the room. I'm like, no, I need to gear up before I go into the room. It's like, that's not even a question at this point. Because I need to make sure that I'm protected before I go in there. And goddamn, it's hard as hell doing a 45-minute code with 3 people doing compression with an N95 on your face. But that's what you got to do to protect yourself. I came out of there drenched with like a sweat line down to my belly button and barely passing and like damn near passing out a couple of times. But at the same time, it's like, I'm going to do what I can to protect this person. But at the same time, I need to make sure I have enough PPE on myself to make sure that I'm not exposed and not going to be in that person's position.
Right. And I think protecting ourselves, 100%, yes. But I think also one thing we're missing is that some of our quick reactions instinctively can lead to exposing other people. Particles in the air, right? Generating in the air. So one of the things that's always such a hot topic in and out of this is disconnecting the ventilator. And you instinctively react to a code and you run into a room and you decide to disconnect it later and start banging patients that you're surrounded by like 20 other people doing compressions. You automatically expose everybody in that instance. If you react with your instincts or your heart versus walking through the procedures through your head before so. And doing what's best, not only for what the patient is, but for yourself and for everyone around you. And that's something you don't want to hold on yourself and against others too.
We're lucky enough we're at institutions, we're supplying with the appropriate amount of PPE. But how do you fight your instincts when you're at an institution that's not supplying the appropriate amount of PPE? And you're faced with the dilemma of, do I run into this room or do I have to run into another unit to gown up and grab the appropriate PPE before I go in there and this patient crashes?
Yeah,
I think that's a good point. I'm gonna pause you on that because I think we'll get to that point in a bigger discussion. But let's talk about like the steps that like lead up to that. So Lance, I mean, you've been practicing for quite some time now. And let's take your thought process, you know, for example. You happen to be taking care of someone and you are walking through the unit. You're not necessarily in their room. They may be on ISO for something. We don't exactly know what. But, you know, from the outside, you see their saturation drop from 100 to 80 to 90 to 70. Like, mm-hmm. What do they teach you in school? You know, as a respiratory therapist, someone's SAT is dropping, their pulse is dropping. What does it tell you?
Disconnect, like,
even before that, right? They say, get to the hell of the head. get to the head of the bed, because this is your problem, right?
Right. Yeah. Yell out for help, just like you would in a BLS, and get to the problem. You're right.
So it all starts with, you know, what brought us to the table was this great, overwhelming compassion for wanting to take care of people. That's what brought us to the table, and that's what kind of drives some of our reactions. But then our training also, at the same time, kind of prompts us to almost make decisions without thinking, right?
Yeah, it's a fine balance between the two, it would seem at this point. Simple enough to say, but I guess you got to check yourself every single time in terms of, I mean, what's happening now and with normal circumstances, you're especially in the ED, right? I mean, that where you don't know anything's gonna, what you're gonna be presented with in terms of the patient that's desaturating, like Justin said, or somebody rolling in with it, like scabies or lice, or, you know, just to come to find out maybe they're still in too much and you might want to be ruled out to C. diff once you finally get to the ICU and you've been like wrestling with this patient before they got intubated.
It just doesn't seem that like the way that we're trained fully embraces kind of this motto that you said, right? Check yourself. You know, who said that? You check yourself before you wreck yourself. You know, like the way that we're trained doesn't fully embrace that model. Like it says react.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And even in best circumstances, when we have PPE, perhaps we need to be looking at how we really train people. And I know you train a lot of new hires. Is this something you talk about with them, like protecting themselves? And
oh, almost definitely. It's a step one, especially when we start to rotate into the ER, or in all cases, and essentially is before you get in the room, you don't know what you're going to expect. So whatever you're presented with whether it's a gunshot, shock trauma, opening up the chest and you're bleeding everywhere, blood splitting, you want to make sure you're gowned up, you have a face shield on, you have a mask on, just in case you're positive for something, and you have gloves, generally. And I mean, given nowadays, you're probably going to possibly assume COVID, so you better be prepared with like a PAPR or something. But definitely always educating these new hires or these new people or even students at before they even enter anything, they should be properly donned with appropriate gear.
How about you, Rob? Like, have you been in a circumstance where maybe it's not the new hire, but it's, you know, it's the most experienced person on the block? Have you been in a situation where you had to take a moment of pause and remind them, like, hey, this is really dangerous. You need to take care of yourself.
The hard part about that is it's not. This isn't limited to our profession. This is just healthcare in general.
Absolutely.
We all get into this with the same mindset. We want to help people. The hard part is trying to turn off that reactionary piece in our mind that we hear the code, you rush in because that's what you're taught. You see someone crashing, you get in there and you do everything possible because time is of the essence. Seconds matter in someone's life. But at the same time, I have to protect myself because we're almost taught to put others' care above yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So where is the line drawn? Because there's no absolute line where you're saying, well, okay, I have to do this or I have to do that. The hard part is being able to retrain yourself to think in a responsive type of manner as opposed to a reactionary type of manner.
Yeah.
Because your instincts, they're strong as hell, especially for people that love what they do and people that feel that service to something greater themselves.
Yeah, it becomes that ethical dilemma with yourself. Am I going to help the patient or should I help myself?
Do you also feel that as healthcare providers, you share some burden of what happens to the patient? Like you feel hugely responsible and maybe overly responsible, where we were trained to be the hero that you have to put yourself below and jump in there, and whatever happens to you, that's just a byproduct of you know, your job. Do you ever feel that like that's something that has been ingrained in you?
In most cases, yes. It's you're doing this in the service of others. You're not thinking about your own welfare normally when this happens. But COVID-19 is brought to the forefront a whole different aspect. Because now people are putting, it's sad to say, it's like we're putting ourselves in danger every day when we take care of these patients. We're possibly exposing ourselves, but now that we have to do this, we understand that we're possibly exposing ourselves, but we're possibly exposing our loved ones when we go home. That's a whole different mindset. We've done that on our normal basis, but at the same time, this has brought it to the forefront of our minds, and it's given a different perspective.
Well, yeah, you're seeing people die in huge numbers, so it's real. It's very tangible. Lance, when you're running into these rooms and reacting, can you honestly say the first thing in your mind is your own health and your family?
Yes, I think I can well say I've trained myself to do that. I won't jump in until I've actually protect myself. And I firmly believe that.
But the hard part is, Lance, how long does it take to set up a PAPR?
It takes a while. It does take a while. And I get it.
Gowning, and then gowning and gloving, and you see this patient going from like 92 to 85.
Sure.
To 79. And you know, once you get on that part of the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve, that's a steep part of the curve, and they just start dropping like all right off a cliff, and you're just like, oh my God.
Oh no, 100%, Rob, and I'm well in knowing that, but I think I've just ingrained in my head every time is just to be prepared every single time. Every time I have the ED, I get a PAPR on, and I kind of have to push that back and say, "It's your wife you're going home to."
Yeah,
yeah.
Can I ask you both a personal question, and I'll chime in, you know, as far as my experience outside of COVID. I mean, you can throw in COVID, but have you guys ever had a actual exposure, needle stick hotline type of exposure where you had to call them, whether it's a prick, a stab, a splash, or anything like that?
Not personally. I've been in charge a few days where people have been exposed, but not personally. It's
Rob.
So yes, I have been susceptible to an exposure. Mine was, we had a patient that came up, and then this patient looked like they just had a fairly bad case of psoriasis. Their arms were crusty, face was crusty, didn't know what was going on. The next thing you know, the patient gets transferred out. 2 days later, notice gets called, this patient had scabies. I went into that room unprotected, just treating the patient as usual. And so did many other people, because there were no isolation precautions put on that patient. We didn't know. Scared the hell out of me, and all of a sudden, Auk Health calls me, and they're like, you know what? You have the option. You can take either a topical cream that you have to wear for 8 hours straight, or you can take a pill that you take twice. For myself, I'm not going to sleep with the damn cream or like walk around with the cream for 8 hours. Just give me the damn pill. But at the same time, you're just like, damn, that makes you take a step back when you have that type of exposure. And not even that, it's horrible. It's like, not even that, it's, with this COVID situation, Auk Health called me. Same thing again. Are you having any symptoms? Are you having any, are you feeling this? Are you feeling that? Luckily, I wasn't. They're like, okay, you're okay to go back to work. But having those exposures under your belt, it changes your perspective.
It really does. And that's why I pose a question. Exposures under best case circumstances. And what I mean by best case is like the ultimate controlled circumstances really sucks. And it's a really, really scary experience. I'll disclose two different stories. It sucks. And it makes you question yourself after the fact. It makes you look at yourself in a different light. Like, you were stupid. You fucked up. What were you thinking? And it does some pretty nasty things to, like, you know, your psyche. This is why I feel so strongly about these things, about protecting yourself. You know, I don't care if, you know, the guy is dousing plutonium or whatever. Like, if that means, like, yeah, you know, like sure, you need to, like, protect yourself.
For sure.
The two exposures that I had were very early on in my career and within months with each other. And it made me really think, like, what the fuck, Justin? Both of them were needle sticks.
Ouch.
The first one was, and I know there are probably tons of therapists going to listen to this and will find themselves in a very similar situation where you get that random call to do an ABG out in, you know, somewhere out in the hospital. You go and you take a look at the patient and you're just like, why am I doing the ABG? And you're just like, whatever. It's easier to just do it than to refute it. So I found myself in that position. Explained the procedure to the guy. He's like, yeah, man, do it, whatever. You know, like, I don't really care. Thought I was very careful with, you know, my approach. Stuck him. What happened? Withdrew like everyone else, and when he withdrew, needle came and grazed me. Had to go through all the testing. You know, it was a very, very scary time. You know, I tell a lot of people that I train right now, or one of the best phrases that I've learned in healthcare to this day, and I use it just for practically everything, is a ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And it was just like, Jesus Christ, if you were just a little bit more careful about your approach, and if you just, you know, if something was off, why didn't you just, you know, call it right there? But he didn't, you know, because I felt obligated. I felt like I had to do these things. I put myself at risk.
So Lance says he's never been exposed.
Well, I thought you meant like needle sticks and whatnot.
No, as a practitioner, you may never have been exposed.
Ooh.
But as a student, I distinctly remember a story.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, God.
Regarding trachs.
Oh, God. I actually tell this story. How could I completely forget? So the story goes, so that, you know, I always tell everyone I orient this story, so I don't know why I lost track of it. But so the story goes, I was on a rotation doing floor care for a trach patient. Well, no, that's not what the patient did. but who required tracheal suctioning, right? And did it for the therapist who, quite frankly, could have taught me a little better in terms of positioning.
Oh, don't blame him.
but I ended up, this patient was on a trach collar, you know, room air, pulled it off, you know, oxygenated, and then we ended up suctioning the patient, suctioned a bunch of stuff, cool, and kept the trach collar off since he was on room air, and we were going to get ready to do some cleaning. You know, patiently waited for my preceptor to go grab some stuff at the end of the bed. And I probably didn't even have to suction this patient because this patient had such a freaking strong spontaneous cough. So much so, he coughed right onto the bottom of my lip. That was the worst. Oh my God. I ran straight to the sink and washed my face, my lip, pulled anything I had that soap on it. And yeah, that's pretty bad.
Yeah. How can you forget that instance?
I don't know. Well, you said needle stick, so I automatically was thinking, like, I never stuck myself or got stuck.
Because I thought about that, and I'm like, that is probably one of the worst instances I've heard of exposure.
Yeah, that was disgusting. Yeah.
Because you learn the phrase, if you're staring down the barrel of a shotgun, you're in the line of fire, so step to the side.
I think that was just... I definitely stepped to the side, but that was to the side of the end of the bed is what I stepped to. God. Oh man, yeah. that was terrible.
I bet it was.
Yeah, let me ask you guys a question.
How did it taste?
I don't know, because I straight to soap. You know,
his tongue went to the back of his throat on that one. He's like,
I wish I had a bottle of Lafroy so I could just dump it right on my lip and taste this peaty thing all over again.
Oh, boy. All
right. What were you asking, Lance?
Question is, so it's funny you brought that up because that was fairly early on in my career. Rob, your exposure was fairly early on your career. Justin, that was also pretty early on your career as well, like you said.
Yeah.
Do you think healthcare workers are more susceptible earlier on in their career, being fresh therapists, being fresh nurses, being fresh whatever it is, because of the lack of experience? If we did a poll right now or a tally in terms of experienced healthcare workers versus non-experienced healthcare workers, do you think there might be more exposure towards the less experienced healthcare workers?
Hell yes.
Maybe. Yeah, there may be a pattern where there are people who are fairly new in their career where you may see they have way more exposures. Mm-hmm. And I bet you if you did a follow-up, a longitudinal study, I bet what you'll see is that pattern will drop off because people learn from their mistakes.
For sure.
And then what you'll see is over time, right? Like just like everything else, people get lax and you'll see another spike, which may be, you know, an X part of your career. So what I think you'll see is a pattern over a career of like spikes just because of behaviors and like exposures.
So essentially you're saying is the bottom of the curve is, I don't know, to the top of the curve, I learned, to the bottom, back to the curve of, it's whatever.
Yeah. Right. That's kind of how we adapt, right? Think about like a lot of the things we do is just like, I think of modalities. Things are in vogue, so we do a lot of it, and then it just kind of tapers off, and then we don't see it for a while, and then we do a lot of it again.
Yeah.
I think that's just like exposures, right? You don't take it seriously. Like if you're going into it in this mindset of like, this is my duty, this is my calling, I have to be in there for your patients. You're not thinking of your family you're going home to necessarily immediately.
Right.
And so, yeah, you're reacting and you're more susceptible and prone to actually getting exposures. And right. And like I tell everyone I orient and I train and students, even experienced people, it only takes one phone call in the middle of the night to the needle stick hotline to make you be like, what was I thinking? And so, yeah, I do think exposures, is very much like the tide where there's these ebbs and flows, like you have high points and you have low points over someone's career. So to say that someone who's new is probably more prone to exposure, that may be true. But what I think is also true is over time, you will see repeated patterns if we don't like hammer into them. Protect yourself. Before you wreck yourself.
Respiratory, nice motto. Protect yourself before you wreck yourself. That's our motto.
So, but the other big thing about it is you have to understand in the beginning, How traumatic was that experience of that exposure to you?
Absolutely. That's where you learn.
Because the more traumatic the experience, the more it's going to stick with you. Because I'm pretty sure you don't stand directly in front of a trach anymore.
I just don't stand in front of trachs anymore at all.
No, he puts his mouth directly over the stomach.
He goes, I miss that taste. I miss that taste. It was, I just love it when they cough on my face. That's what Lance is thinking.
Yeah, remember that simple syrup I made for you guys one time? Yeah, there it is. Collected all that sputum.
But that's the thing. It's how traumatic that was. I still remember as a student, I felt bad because I was with my preceptor and he let me do an ABG. And then I handed off the needle to him. Next thing you know, it wasn't the one, it's not the current ABG needles now where you flip the cap on top of. It's the one where you push the cap on top of. Slide the cap on top of the needle.
Yeah, those.
So I didn't slide it all the way to where you hear the click.
Yeah.
So he put his finger on top and it slid down and it pricked him. And all of a sudden I just heard, "Ah, shit." And he's just like, "God damn it, I just pricked myself." He's like, "I'm gonna have to call the hotline." I'm like, I'm looking at him, I'm like, "The way you're reacting, this isn't the first time that's happened to you."
That is very true. I see people like damn near in tears when they do that. So yeah.
And then the other time, again, I'm brand new. I'm new to the profession. I'm going to do a suction on I forget what I'm doing to a patient, but I'm doing a disconnect. Nurse is standing on the opposite side of the bed. I don't think about it.
Oh, God, I know this story.
I do a disconnect. All of a sudden, whoosh.
Woo.
There's some fluid in the line, catches them in the face. All I heard is, "Goddamn bullshit, son of a bitch, what are you doing? Why don't you tell me you're going to do a disconnect?" And I'm just like, "Oh my God, I just done fuck up."
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I will reconnect. And all you can do is just like, "Oh, that is horrible. What did I just do?" So now for myself, every time that a patient or like if I'm precepting somebody, they're going to do a disconnect and there's a nurse there, I'm like, "Wait, hold on. We're about to do a disconnect. Please step off to the side." And then they're like, "Oh, thanks. I didn't think about that." And I'm just like, "Oh, I know exactly why you shouldn't be doing that with or anybody on that side."
Well, I just hit the manual disconnect button. No, I'm just kidding.
He's a smart ass over here. Right? There's tons of reasons of why people are often exposed. Education is kind of one of those. How we're primed, you know, as healthcare people is definitely one, and how we're trained is definitely one. I want to talk a little bit about systems and actual training of not necessarily what, you know, our pre-hospital training, you know, in the classrooms, but I want to talk about like how exposure ties into certain systems that we have and training as in the sense of providers being familiar with the equipment. Is all PPE made the same?
It sure is not, which is why all healthcare workers should get to know their PPE. I mean, if I go into a trauma with a patient that's going to bleed out, I'm not hoping to wear my yellow toilet paper gown. I'm hoping to wear my wonderful blue gown that actually can propel blood off of me so that doesn't seep through and just be stupid to wear, you know? I'm not going to wear my surgical mask into a person that's has no TB, you know? I'm going to wear the appropriate N95 that I've been tested for and that fits me because I know the large just won't fit me because it'll leak on the side. So no, not all PPE is made the same.
Training a substitute for common sense practice? I've heard the excuse a lot that like, "Hey, they say that the surgical mask may be okay, but I see a lot of caution signs in the door that this is really high ISO. Should I just go in with my surgical mask? Like, how would you approach that situation?
So I think in the world of COVID, it changes a lot of the standards of practice because it's ever changing. What's right, what's wrong is going to change from hour to hour, it would seem nowadays. So in this case scenario, I think I would do what's fitting for me. Obviously abide to a majority of the standard procedures and protocols. But for me, I'm always on the overly cautious side. So I would lean towards wearing my N95 that I own.
I like that. I like that train of thought, and I definitely adapt the same model. When in doubt, for any type of ISO, you know, COVID, non-COVID, TB, whatever the hell it is, you know, Ebola. Mm-hmm. If there is some inclination, if there is the PPE available, right? Because I know some people are going to make the argument, though, well, you know, like our institution only has this. And I, like, if I have all the proper tools at my disposal, it almost makes sense to just look goofy. And you know, worst case scenario, you look goofy.
Who cares?
You're the one guy in the room that's in the astronaut suit tending to this patient. You know, guess what? In worst case scenario, you're also the one guy that doesn't need to be, you know, follow the exposure protocol. So I would say when in doubt, go with your gut and use probably, you know, the best PPE, you know, not the best PPE, but the smartest PPE plan that you can formulate for yourself. Again, right? Protect yourself before you wreck yourself.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. You think everyone thinks the same, though?
No. Yeah. That's the whole reason why we're talking about this.
Right. So which brings back to my point is I think education is important to this. I mean, if you look at what we did for Ebola training in terms of education, it was extensive. It would require like crazy amounts of training just to don appropriately in hazmat.
But when did you get that training? You got that training as a practicing therapist,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Should the burden of training solely be on like the institution that you work at? Or should this be ingrained, you know, in Lance, in Rob, in Justin, and everyone else from the start, you know, semester one? Should we not only change the practices of how we train people in hospitals, but how we train people from the get-go? A lot of this stuff is repetition. If I heard early on in my education that, hey, Justin, you're going to die from this shit if you get it, be smart. It actually may change my mindset of how I approach these things. If for nothing else, you know, the message that I hope people get is you are just as important as a person that you're trying to help, you're trying to save. We need you just as much as everyone else and just as much as that patient does. And you are in the hospital for what sometimes seems indefinitely or an eternity, but you're in there for a finite amount of time and you leave and you have other people in your life that count on you and you want to be there for them. So if for nothing else, being smart. Yeah, I realize there are PPE shortages across the United States. And I am so lucky that I'm not working somewhere that has reached rock bottom yet. And for the people that have, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you have to live through that. And I am so sorry that your family and everyone who comes in contact with you and your patients, and they have to be exposed to that as well. And I hope that things get better where you guys are. But if you are not there yet, be smart. And even if you are there, with whatever you have, you know, make the smartest educational choices that you can. And remember that you are valuable.
100%. Yeah. Educate, and educate yourselves. Make sure to be mindful. You might not have PPE in that area, but like Justin said, take care of yourselves. If there's no PPE and that scenario pops up, take the time to think about it. Find out how you can get your PPE. Is there anyone around you that's wearing PPE right now that can respond to it? Shout out to them. Tell them to get in there until you're able to take care of yourself and you can also assist with the process.
Okay. Here's a question that might cause a little backlash with people currently in the room. What do you do about people that can't wear N95s because they haven't taken care of their facial hair? What do you say to those people?
Wear your pepper. Wear your pepper.
Yeah, I know some people will pose the argument of there's no pappers, or I haven't been trained on a papper, or this and that. And, you know, for me, I guess if I was really in that, if that was like the cards that were dealt for me, I would have to really think beyond just like looks and, you know, aesthetic. And I would get rid of my beard, you know, like if that's what you want to hear, I'm going to get rid of my beard if we get rid of pappers. But because I've been using pappers, not exclusively COVID, because I've been using pappers since like TB, all these other things, I know how to use a papper. I'm going to use it.
or get really really extra, throw that N95 on and take your shirt off and put it over your face and spin it like a helicopter.
Oh, awesome. I think the real take home message here is protect yourself before you wreck yourself. I'm gonna cut this now. Definitely. Because I don't want to hear these two talk any longer.
You're wrong for that, Rob.
I know. You're definitely wrong for that. You know, you stabbed me with that one. In any event, this has been another episode of Respiratory on Ice. I'm Justin Phillips, along with my compadres,
Lance Spangalina
and Rob Bautista.
It has been a fun one. Please, please, everyone, stay safe. We appreciate you all. We'll catch you next time.
Stay safe.